Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Liberty Ventures podcast. My name is Alexander McCobin, the founder and CEO of Liberty Ventures, and filming live from Richard Branson's private island, Necker Island, here in the Virgin Islands. And just thrilled to have one of our participants, a great guy who I got to know this past year, who's in the broader Liberty Ventures ecosystem, Colin Greenspan, who started and runs Naria Ventures, which we got a great overview of this morning, Colin. But before we even get into that, I just want to say, thanks for coming out to the summit. Thanks for being here on the podcast and sharing your insights with everyone.
No, it's a wonderful event you're putting on. It's fabulous to be here. I think, there, as I said earlier, there's this real spirit of sharing ideas, and there's such a bunch of dynamic personalities from very different backgrounds, and so it's unlike any event I've probably been to beyond this incredible setting where you actually are learning something new. Very few investors, some people in tech, some people in music. And it's just that sort of diversity of thought, I think, is really important. And as someone who invests mostly in technology, I always look to get away from that for inspiration. And also having folks to challenge some of my theses. And so that's, and doing it in a collaborative way. It's been a very constructive group.
I'm thrilled to hear that. And I know that you, even in starting Naria, were really driven by a philosophy and a set of ideas for how you want to approach investing. So I want to just start there, especially to better understand your background and story that led you to starting Naria, what the ideas driving that are.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, our anchor investor is Peter Thiel. He sits on the investment committee with me. And one of the, he started out, and he's talked about this, he started out in law for a very hot second and very quickly got out. I was someone who started in law for maybe similar reasons. I didn't really think about what I wanted to do with my future. I sort of did well in high school, did well in college, got into good law school, I just was checking these boxes and not really thinking about it. And it was really like 3 or 4 years into practicing law where I sort of picked my head up and I kind of said, well, what is this really what I want to be doing? And I thought about all sorts of different opportunities. I'm still learning. I'm still like honing the craft of corporate law.
Sure.
And so I think it was the right move. I ultimately felt that just I need to give it a few more years and be opportunistic, also sort of believe in karma a little bit. It just over time, like something like it would work itself out. I would find something I was more passionate about. My wife and I ended up moving from New York City to the Bay Area. It still is a lawyer, but once I was there, as serendipity would have it, I connected with Peter and a broader team that was starting a venture fund, and I was able to sort of get on board there and then start my venture career. And I've been in investing in tech companies longer than I practiced law, but as I said this morning, I just appreciate it so much more because I started from a place with a career path that didn't really inspire me. And I didn't really feel like I was sort of helping in any material way. And for better or worse, I'm an investor and that's where I should be. I'm not an operator. I don't necessarily have the genius to build these companies myself, but I think given what we do, there's some pattern recognition. We invest all across all sorts of sectors, very macro driven, and investing that way allows us indirectly to sort of have this interesting impact if our companies are successful on sort of improving the state of our country.
And if I can jump in real quick, I mean, I noticed there is a trend with a lot of people transitioning from law into investing, especially into venture. And there's a big difference between those two worlds. In law, you basically have a zero-sum game. You have a winner and a loser in most situations, whereas in venture and business, it's a positive-sum game. The whole idea is to create more value for everyone, which can be so much more energizing and just have a more optimistic view of the world. I'm curious what you think about that.
I think that's true in aspects of law. I mean, a lot of what I did was corporate law, so there were specific points you'd be negotiating against your counterparty. But if it was mergers and acquisitions or a joint venture, ultimately these folks were trying to do business together. So it was less combative than some aspects of law. But I did do acquisitions out of bankruptcy and a bunch of other things that were a little more combative. And so I think that spirit of not having it be a zero-sum game is really exciting for a couple of reasons. And And one of the things I just love about venture as an asset class is you think about like what I call on the private side, on the alternative side, some is public, but like the three big buckets where you're investing in companies with private capital, there's sort of hedge funds where for the most part you're sort of at, maybe you're doing some bear hug or activist investing, but mostly you're really just kind of trading in shares and not really engaging with the companies. And so that never really resonated with me with what I wanted to do. And there's sort of the private equity model, the leveraged buyout sort of structure where you're ultimately buying a business and trying to make it more efficient and leveraging that with some debt to then flip it and sell it. And that has been very lucrative, but in many cases, you can be cynical and say, well, you're actually extracting value because you're sort of, you might have to fire a bunch of people and you're not, you know, you're sort of fixing something that's broken or is inefficient or something. Whereas venture, this is this opportunity. It's almost like this tabula rasa very early on to go support in any way you can these great founders with these ambitious ideas to go build for the future and just help. And just, you know, and that's sometimes that's specific things and like rolling up your sleeves. Sometimes it's getting out of the way. But the other great thing about the zero sum game point is you can syndicate with other great investors. And so we as generalists are doing everything from we're looking at alternative energy, we're doing biotech, we're investing in religion and free speech and all these interesting ideas that relate to these sort of acute problems we have in our country right now. But why not partner with, you know, an expert in energy and nuclear fission? Why not partner with a strategic corporate investor that's going to be a customer? And maybe you take a little less ownership in the business, but a lot of these outcomes are going to be pretty binary 5 to 10 years from now. And so it's actually much better to have more advocates in your camp. And so that's, to me, that's why venture is so inspiring and why it's sort of, never a dull moment. And that sort of permeates the downstream investor relationships as well.
I couldn't agree more. Getting into the venture space only recently, but yeah, it is such a collaborative space compared to others out there, which is one of the exciting parts of it.
Yeah.
And okay, we kind of veered away from allowing you to talk about the ideas behind Narya and you starting that. So let's get back to that.
Yeah, I think, so I was living in the Bay for some time and I was always thinking about what the world was missing and trying to look out 5 to 7 years. And I was really flexible enough to have a platform that allowed me to do that versus a structure where you're just taking inbound from other investors saying, hey, I have this company that's raising the next round, will you look? Or the founder's calling you. And of course, that's part of the job. But I use that more as like to measure signal to noise ratios. And what we really try to do is sort of have a thesis and go out and try to see if there's a business that that is somewhat aligned with what we're doing, because there you already have the conviction, and then it's just a question, is it the right founder? Are you aligned? Are the terms right? And so, but through doing that, we just noticed that there was, especially in the Bay, there was just becoming this, like GPs were really, or folks running venture funds and their teams were really over-indexing to enterprise software and consumer internet businesses. And those are great businesses. They can scale very quickly. You don't need as many dollars in the door. But if you're thinking about sort of more looking at it from a more patriotic angle, like there's this question around what good are those companies doing if they're not, if they're getting acquired by bigger companies, they're not really moving the bottom line, they're not creating any new jobs, and you sort of have this like recycling of capital that's kind of going to the same people, and I guess some people call that a virtuous cycle. I would argue that it highlights that maybe Silicon Valley has outgrown itself a little bit and we need to start thinking about innovation again like Silicon Valley used to do. It's like this weird situation where Silicon Valley is now behaving like the incumbents it originally set out to disrupt. And not everyone, and I'm generalizing to make the point, but I just think there's so many intractable problems in energy, in manufacturing, in defense, in curing disease, in other aspects of the healthcare system, that it's bad for our country, it's bad for the planet not to be going after these, And it's also an amazing opportunity for our fund and our investors to generate returns, because these will be the companies that like really become the sort of the durable franchises of the future. And that's really exciting.
So I intuitively think that you're right, but let's make this really tangible. So like, what's an example of one of those intractable problems that intractable, there we go, that you have tackled with some of your investing and that you're really excited to do more in?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different lenses in which we look at this stuff. But I think there's one example is in defense. For a very long time, there were not a lot of tech startups in defense, partly because there were some technical challenges, partly because I think a lot of investors in funds saw that defense equaled offense, and you weren't really supposed to invest in weapons companies and things. But luckily, with a few really good companies over the past, say, 10 years, that the venture market has opened back up. And we got very excited about that world. But we had also, at the same time, been investing in different space technologies. And as we were thinking through what was next in space, we were just very frustrated that most of the companies that we saw were doing very similar things. There were small satellite constellations. There were sort of various imaging technologies that were going to observe Earth for various use cases. There's some additive manufacturing, like rocket businesses, which are kind of interesting, but they're all sort of using the same technology. And so it was like one of these things where the CAGR of like space tech was like going to be really high. VCs were going to keep backing these companies. But I just didn't feel like I had a strong thesis on differentiation. And so we started talking about sovereignty. I think we're past peak globalization. I think international competition is increasing. And we just, cybersecurity is becoming a bigger issue. And we just started talking about how do we protect our sovereignty. And then we combine that with some of our defense knowledge and some of our space tech experience. And we sort of said, well, we have all these critical assets in orbit now. Like, how are we protecting them? And well, we have the Space Force, which is pretty new, or a government organization, and they have been effective in some ways and not effective in others. And during this sort of inquiry, we found a few folks that had spun out of Space Force and they basically tried to build this internally. And one, the governmental organization was too nascent, and two, it was too governmental. And so they spun out and they said, we can build this for Space Force and a bunch of other public and private sector customers in a much more efficient way. The existing primes cannot do it. They're just not equipped for the next gen technology you need to sort of protect satellites and other infrastructure that's in orbit, because the physics are much more complicated. The docking is complicated. There's a bunch of reasons why it's much harder than doing stuff at a maritime or terrestrial level. And we found a company, we invested, and they just raised another $100 million like last month, and all, early days, but in a really good position to become like the space prime. And so that's a long process. Like, we're only doing a couple deals a year. That's a thesis that develops over months or years in some cases. And we did just, and then I'll be quiet, but we did something also in manufacturing. We sort of think that onshoring manufacturing capabilities is not only makes economic sense, to bring down unit economics and anything you want to buy in the States, it also creates real jobs, and the technology is in a place where you can sort of layer on AI, or let's call it advanced compute, because AI is kind of a buzzword, but just like whatever the state-of-the-art software is on top of real hardware and 3D printing to do really cool things. And so we have a company in Detroit doing changing the tooling and die industry. And that's like, no one's talking about tooling and die in venture, but it's like this mom and pop massive market that's completely fragmented and needs technology. And so we're starting, we're seeing a lot of these things in these categories, and this bits plus atoms symbiosis is like getting really interesting.
So you're already giving a lot of insights to how you think as an investor and the opportunities that you're looking for, especially being so intentional with your thesis for this. But especially for other investors in the Liberty Ventures ecosystems, you've been doing this for a while. Is there anything that you're doing nowadays different from when you first got into venture that you think is a really important lesson that you would be willing to share with everyone?
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing I think is taking fewer meetings, which what I mean by it's sort of trusting your instincts and making sure you have a real thesis, or at least kind of, or if you don't have a thesis, being very cognizant of the fact that you don't have a thesis. And that's okay. You'll need a couple like good ideas per fund to really hit, which obviously is very hard, but like even a couple interesting ideas a year moves the needle. If you're someone on a bigger venture team, that's all you need. If you're a smaller team, you're probably going to be doing a handful of deals a year at most. And so like there's this tendency to want to talk to everyone. It's because it is a cottage industry. It's growing and people are very social, which is, so there's a lot of opportunities to engage, but it just takes up so much time. And, you know, I think having that opportunity to do real research, do real due diligence, obviously 23, we saw a lot of examples of companies that were invested in where there clearly wasn't any diligence done. You just can't do that if you're going to meetings all the time or you're on Zooms or whatever. And so that I think is the biggest thing. And like really seeing if you have unique thought and then going and trying to sort of find those opportunities and it just make you a better value added investor to your portfolio companies as well.
I think that's absolutely brilliant, especially as advice for investors. I'm curious to ask for the other side. You know, you have met with a lot of founders, you invest in some fantastic founders out there. What are some of the key things that you look for in founders outside of that differentiation and these key questions that need to be resolved that you can share?
You know, it's always interesting to think about like an archetype of a founder and like impart some wisdom on folks about sort of, because it's always very bespoke in some ways because these companies were doing so many different things. What I would say that is probably the most interesting is that there's kind of in almost like opposite, like there's some industries and some business opportunities where it's really good to have tried it before and know exactly what you want to build and have that true, let's call it industrial or sector acumen, where you're like clearly an expert. And maybe like our true anomaly folks, where they were at Space Force and had other relevant backgrounds and they tried it, and this is just a continuation of something they're working on. That archetype of a founder works really well in certain industries. And maybe the ones that are a little more hard tech, where but there's also this like interesting way in which some of our best founders are sort of the opposite, where they come to their hidden insight and see around the corner of a market through experience, through observing something in a category and saying, oh, that's not right. But hey, I was working here and I can use those tools to go transform an industry. So the concrete example there is, there's the big data company Palantir that we've all heard of, and very successful business, solved a lot of big problems in a lot of industries as well as the public sector. We have a e-broker that sells Medicare that was started by an ex-Palantir person. And he saw how hard it was for his parents when they became Medicare eligible to find a plan that made sense to them, that had enough details where they understood exactly what they were getting, and gave them enough data to really make an informed decision. And it was sort of you're hitting this inflection point in people's lives. It's sometimes a terrifying time because in those scenarios, you're probably not working because it's not your employer doing it. And so he said, well, this is wrong. Everyone talks about how healthcare is broken. This is a specific, like e-brokerage is broken. Okay, so what do we do about it? We need more information. We need to democratize data. And what better person to do that than someone that has solved all these big data problems and structured and unstructured data in a way that people can make sense of. And so they took that, applied it to Medicare, and they're one of the fast growing brokers. And the other sort of hook to it that was interesting is they said, we're going to give the data to everyone and on every plan. So if you're eligible, you're going to get all the information. And we might recommend a plan where we're not going to get a commission, but we're going to build trust that way. So they have a much stickier customer base. And for all these reasons, they're probably the fastest growing in the market right now, The industry is pretty broken. And so maybe there's some low-hanging fruit there. But that's like that archetype is so amazing because mission-driven, seeing your parents struggle with something and say, I actually have some different skills because maybe the people who are in the industry now don't really have the skills and don't really care because of these incumbents that are just kind of printing money and they don't care if they're, you know, the NPS are low or whatever. So those are two examples, and there's probably some others, but I really like those two.
Well, I think that's fantastic, Colin. And, you know, especially given that you said you recommend having fewer meetings to investors. One of the things I always advise people is if they want to connect with someone or learn a new industry to reach out and offer to do something, offer to actually give value and help them out. And so given your high bar actually for taking meetings and connecting with people, I'm curious, if someone reached out to you and offered to do something to help you out, what could they offer to do that you would be excited to see and positively respond to?
I will say that it's the type A person in me where I am pretty responsive on email. I'll be efficient with it, but I might not take the physical meeting. I think that, you know, there's always clearly folks that are like looking for a job, and the best way to sort of get in the door there is not to like send a resume. Maybe that's okay, but it's more to be like, hey, it's to be specific, have a specific ask. It doesn't even need to be doing me a favor. It's you reach out, I'm assuming that's the use case, and you say, hey, I saw you invest, you do the work. That's I guess the problem on the interest. I feel like people don't do the work. Say, oh, I really want to get into venture. And then if you meet with them, they don't have any thoughts. They just like think venture's cool and they don't really know anything about it. But if you actually have folks that say, hey, I looked at your portfolio. We have a bunch of stealth companies, but a lot of it is on the web, on our website and other sources, and say, you know, I love that you did this investment. It makes me think of this thing that I came across, or this idea. It doesn't have to be a company, this idea, and just sort of extrapolate that way. That's really interesting. Or even better, the best email was I got someone said, I saw you invest in this company. That company is terrible. I don't get it. Like, I think you're going to lose money on that. It's kind of bold, but you know, I was kind of defensive, but I also was like intrigued, like, okay, this person, I like that this person has, you know, the comfort in making these, you know, making this statement and actually having an opinion. And so that's also like a pretty interesting way. And then I think, you know, as far as getting together, it's sort of like, are there the right synergies? But, you know, in investors that I compare notes with, like that's sort of like what, like, let's not just go get coffee. If we're going to get coffee, let's have a specific goal in mind. And then so I like to sort of start, you know, prelude to a meeting is actually let's have some goals. We might riff and digress or whatever. That's fine. And then when we leave, let's not say, oh, let's talk soon or like, you know, see, you know, just like have something vague. Like, let's have a concrete next step. And that way I think you can keep your relationships tighter and more fruitful for both sides.
Colin, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time for the podcast and being here.
That's great. Thanks for having me, and you know, really appreciate all that you guys are doing.
Appreciate all you're doing.
Yeah. Talk soon.
Yeah. Thanks.